At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's higher than Robinhood, SoFi, Wealthfront, Capital One, and the big banks, too. Ready to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash? Check out the high-yield cash account on Public.com. This is paid for by Public Investing. 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Coming up on the broadcast today, football and fairness. College, when you're the first in your family to go. And our new series, I've Always Wondered. Rental cars today, by the way. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. This is the Marketplace Podcast from Monday, the 10th of February. Good as always to have you with us. And we begin the broadcast today with a story that's a complicated mix of the human condition, the economic marketplace, relative worth in a highly competitive field, and it's about big business to boot. It's about football and a really talented college athlete named Michael Sam, who said last night that he's gay. Not newsworthy in and of itself, except he said it to ESPN and the New York Times, and it has been the story of the business of sports and society today. Holly Anderson covers college football for ESPN's Grantland. Holly, it's good to have you here.
Hi.
So for those who until last night had not heard of Michael Sam, how good a football player is this guy?
He is one of the more decorated players you'll find in college football this season. As a defensive player, he obviously doesn't get as much attention nationally as some of your offensive stars would. But, you know, just to rattle off a few, he was a first-team All-American. He was named the SEC Defensive Player of the Year. You know, that's nothing to sneeze at in the SEC. Yeah. And I think most importantly, he was named team MVP by his own teammates, you know, a season after he told them
that he was gay. Right. Which mm-hmm. brings us to the nub of this thing. He now has come out and said he is gay before the NFL draft. Now what happens?
It's really, you know, it doesn't seem like there would ever be a perfectly ideal time to do this, because while he did, you know, drop this news this early in the hopes that it wouldn't be a big deal by the time of the draft, there's still the NFL Combine.
Which is where the college, you know, the top college players go and basically demonstrate their skills, right?
Yeah. You have to be in, it's an invitation-only affair. You show up, you do all these tricks for the scouts and managers and coaches in attendance, and he'll be doing that just, you know, a couple weeks after all this came out. So that is a big deal.
Do you think this could mean he goes undrafted? Forget dropping down a round or two, which there's already that buzz out there. But could it be that now general managers say, not only will there be upset in the locker room, but I just don't need the headache, the media circus that will come with this?
I certainly hope not, of course. But one thing I want to say is that I don't know, but it's a very confident I don't know, because we don't know that teams aren't going to dismiss the notion of distractions entirely and not even feel that they're taking a flyer on him, a team that's going to be very confident in this pick. And realistically, we also don't know that there aren't teams feeding negative information about him so they can get him at a steal.
Boy, that's cynical and Machiavellian, I'll tell you what.
It's the NFL.
Yeah. Well, speaking of which, the NFL's got a lot on its hands right now, right? It's got the concussion thing going on. Is it possible, and yes, this is hypotheses, but is it possible that Roger Goodell, the commissioner, is sort of saying, we need not to have this become a big, bad thing for us?
It is my fervent hope that in some part of the black pit where his heart should be, Roger Goodell, who is a businessman,
right,
we're moving towards a future where this is going to be good business for teams, for college and NFL both. We're moving towards, you can see in the response from Michael's teammates how they're bragging this morning about the family environment that team has created at Missouri, about, you know, being accepting of cultural differences. It's going to come to a point where it's going to be good business to accept all kinds of people. And hopefully the NFL's smart enough to see this, because if nothing else, and he is nothing else, Roger Goodell is a pragmatist.
You know, it's funny. This all goes to the Branch Rickey moment, right? Branch Rickey, of course, integrated baseball with the Brooklyn Dodgers and Jackie Robinson 50 or 60 years ago.
And you know, no one ever forgave the Dodgers for that.
Yeah, that's right. But, you know, there is a general manager out there who's like, you know what, this is the right thing to do, and it makes economic sense.
And he's an excellent football player, lest we forget.
Holly Anderson, she covers college football for ESPN's Grantland. Holly, thanks so much for your time.
Thanks, Kai.
Wall Street was kind of betwixt and between today, in part because Janet Yellen is making her first trip up to Capitol Hill tomorrow as Fed chair. So watchful waiting pretty much captures the mood. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. A word now about pictures. Maybe pictures in ads or in a news story, but pictures all the same. Try to remember the last one you saw that featured a businesswoman. Was she climbing a ladder or wearing boxing gloves? Trapped in the 1980s, maybe wearing a power suit and clutching a briefcase? A lot of those stereotypical images come from big stockpiles of pictures known as stock photography. Well, now the Lean In Foundation, led by Facebook's Sheryl Sandberg after her book of the same name, is partnering with Getty Images, the big distributor of stock photos, to widen that aperture a little bit, widen the lens. Marketplace's Dan Weissman reports.
Michelle Underwood is an art director for Zocalo Group. They're a marketing firm in Chicago. Looking for stock photos is part of her job.
I want to write a note to stock photographers because every woman on every stock photography website is wearing like a spaghetti strap tank top.
The Lean In collection at Getty Images has 2,500 images that aim to correct the problem. Jessica Bennett helped curate it for the Lean In Foundation, which gets 10% of the revenues from the photos.
You'll notice these people look real. That was one of the biggest things.
And these are not just workplace images. The first few images include a young girl on a skateboard, a mom teaching her daughter how to ride a bike, and a heavy metal dad with his daughter on his shoulders. Thing is, 2,500 images is a very small collection. 60 million on Getty's site alone. Lanny Ziering is an investor who's run stock photo companies.
That's really nothing. What a couple of photographers might be able to create in a week.
Which could be part of the point. There are many millions of stock photos out there. Steve Pickerel's a former stock photographer and an expert on the business. He has me do a very common search on Getty's site.
Woman, office, computer.
We get back about 24,000 images. Pickerel says most people will look through maybe 3 pages of search results. That's 300 images.
What about all those other images? Does anybody ever get to see them? And the answer is no.
So helping this small number of pictures stand out and starting a conversation about them may be the point. Here's Bennett from the Lean In Foundation.
Maybe it has a shaming mechanism. Like, there's no excuse. This collection exists. However small you may think it is, it exists.
I suggest to her that getting a few news stories out there today may be the point of the exercise. She doesn't disagree. In Chicago, I'm Dan Weissman for Marketplace.
Most stories about medical innovations are about technology, sometimes expensive technology. There's new research out in the Journal of the American Medical Association highlighting a decidedly low-tech and inexpensive innovation. Turns out what are known as community health workers, folks earning maybe, what, $15 an hour, are doing what doctors and nurses and social workers often struggle with, keeping sick patients from returning to the hospital again and again. From the Health Desk at WHYY, Marketplace's Dan Gorenstein has that story.
To understand what a community health worker does, let's talk about a real case. A woman kept showing up to the hospital with high blood pressure, a little overweight, complaining of chest pain.
Automatically, people worry that she's having a heart attack.
That's Dr. Shreya Kangovi, an internist with the University of Pennsylvania Medical System and lead author of the new study.
So she comes in, she gets stress tests, she gets EKGs, she gets cardiac catheterizations, she gets medications.
After 6 months of expensive hospitalizations, Kangovi says the patient was paired with a community health worker. It was at that point the patient opened up about a sexual assault.
This had really traumatized her, and it was leading to these feelings of panic and social anxiety.
Ferreting out the source of the problem, says Kangovi, is really what the patient needed, not going to the hospital every month. In fact, she returned just once after that. Kangovi says her randomly controlled trial found high-cost patients who were matched with health workers felt better and were less likely to be readmitted multiple times. Economically, this investment is smart, says Dr. Joshua Sharfstein, the Maryland Secretary of the Department of Health and Mental Hygiene.
is getting admitted again and again, each admission is several thousand dollars, then it is pretty easy to save money with that kind of intervention.
As more pressure is put on hospitals and doctors to save money, the idea of employing these workers is picking up steam.
We're proving out right now that this is a great idea, and there's a handful of early adopting.
Bob Kocher is a former healthcare advisor to President Obama.
We have a bunch of things done by people that are expensive, like doctors, that could be done by people that are lower cost, like community health workers.
Kocher says what's brilliant about more healthcare workers is you get less expensive people doing more work, and work that's more likely to avoid high costs, like showing up at the hospital. I'm Dan Gorenstein for Marketplace. Our education correspondent Amy Scott spent a good chunk of last year in Cincinnati working on a series about a high school there called Euler School and how that school was trying to give kids from a really tough neighborhood a better shot at going to and getting through college. Some of the kids there did graduate, and they're now halfway through their first year of college. It's a sometimes tough first year of college that can be even tougher if you're the first in your family to graduate high school. So today, Amy catches back up with Raven Gribbins, who we met last year at Euler.
Lance, Anissa.
Raven is in trigonometry class, sitting right in the front row.
Adriel.
As the instructor takes attendance, Raven snaps a quick selfie with her phone and sends it off to a guy she's been texting with.
Okay, we're picking up right where we left off.
Then she gets down to business.
So for the angle 330 degrees, first of all, what quadrant does that lie in?
The fourth.
And what is the reference angle? First of all, in degrees?
It's 30.
Raven usually knows the answers. She's been here before. She's studying to be a high school math teacher and took this class last semester. It didn't go so well. One of the first lessons of college, it's not high school.
It's a lot more homework, a lot more studying, and a lot more effort. It was kind of a shock.
A lot about coming to college was a shock. Raven grew up in a poor and dangerous neighborhood in Cincinnati called Lower Price Hill. Neither of her parents finished high school. Both struggled with drug addiction. Raven's just started her second semester at Penn State Greater Allegheny, a small campus near Pittsburgh. Siobhan Brooks is coordinator of the Learning Center, where students like Raven get tutoring and other support services. Brooks says the second semester is where things get real.
I think that is the wake-up time for most. I think the first semester is often trial and error because they're still trying to figure out how this works. Do I really need to be in every class, or can I miss a few and still get it? And I think by the second semester, they catch on.
Raven has tried a lot. She played volleyball. Her team made the playoffs. She got a new boyfriend. They broke up. She got her tongue pierced, something she's wanted to do for years.
I couldn't eat for 3 days.
And she went through two roommates.
I don't get along with females, for real. So I knew I was going to end up with a single by the end of the semester.
The price of all that trial and error, a 2.5 GPA. To get her education degree, she hopes to transfer to the main Penn State campus in State College after her sophomore year. And to do that, she'll need at least a 3.0. So Raven has a plan. At the end of a long day of classes, she meets with one of the two math tutors she's working with, Justin Godani.
Any specific questions on the ones we went over in class?
No.
No? So I can just throw some problems at you and let you solve them?
Yeah.
The tutoring is part of a federally funded program for first-generation and low-income students. Raven will also take a class on study skills, like how to read textbooks and take notes. She has a lot of people watching over her. One of them is her volleyball coach, Tracy Gibbs, who meets with her every week for study hours.
I know her dad in high school, when she lived with him, was always on her about homework. But as it turns out, you know, she needs the same thing still. She needs someone to be the annoying, nagging person to say, did you do X, Y, and Z? Oh, you did? Okay, let me see it now.
But Gibbs says Raven is thriving in other ways.
She's always responsible. She's always on time. She was always the cheerleader, you know, on the court, off the court. I don't think I've ever even seen her angry.
That might surprise some of her high school teachers. Raven used to get in fights and mouth off in class. But while she was back home in Cincinnati for winter break, she says people noticed a change.
They say I'm getting brighter and, like, more educated. Does, like, you learn how to control yourself better. Like, your attitude, you turn into a nice young lady.
Raven says she didn't want to come back to college after the break. She misses her dad and her little sister. Low-income, first-generation college students are far more likely to drop out after their first year than better-off students whose parents went to college. They may be less prepared academically or have financial pressures, or the pull of home is too strong. But Raven did come back.
Because this is a good opportunity for me, and my little sister, she'll understand. And I'm doing it to better my education, so when I get older, I can take care of her if she needs my help.
And what she's left behind, the poverty, the violence, the crime, has also given her an edge. For her education class, Raven gets an assignment to respond to a passage about the effect of poverty on schools.
I could relate to it because it happened when I was a child, when I was growing up.
The instructor, Anthony Mitchell, says Raven's experience will help make her a good teacher.
I'm very happy to have a student that brings her background and brings her perspective. Many students in this class have not had an experience like Raven.
It makes me feel stronger because all the stuff I've been through, I'm still here. I had to work my way to get here.
And she's quickly learning she'll have to work just as hard to stay. In McKeesport, Pennsylvania, I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
The archive of all of Amy's work at Euler called One School, One Year is on our website. It's marketplace.org. And that, of course, is where you'll find the sequel as well. It's called First in the Family. Coming up.
There's this long-standing perception that renters are worse than Evel Knievel.
No, you think? Another installment of our series, I've Always Wondered. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials off 7 points today, closed at 15,801. The NASDAQ up 22 points, about a half percent, ended at 4148. The S&P 500 nudged up 2 points, closed at 1799. Janet Yellen tomorrow on the Hill, as I mentioned. Yahoo and Yelp each helped each other climb after word of a new partnership to beef up Yahoo's local search with Yelp reviews. Yahoo up 1.4%, Yelp nearly 2%. Apple tacked on 1.7% today. That after investor Carl Icahn withdrew his demand that the company buy back more of its stock. An upbeat outlook boosted toymaker Hasbro 4.5%. But McDonald's slipped more than 1% today on disappointing U.S. sales despite good earnings abroad. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year T-notes fell to 2.67%. And you are listening to Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at what's coming up Tuesday. In Washington, the Labor Department releases job openings and labor turnover data for December. Feeling a little stressed? You might have company. The American Psychological Association releases its annual Stress in America survey. And she spent years as a castaway on an uncharted desert isle with no phone, no lights, no motor cars. The movie star, Tina Louise, turns 80. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Today's installment of CEOs Caught in the Harsh Spotlight of Bad Press features a repeat appearance by AOL's Tim Armstrong. Armstrong announced big changes to the company's 401k retirement program last week, and in doing so implied pretty strongly that he was doing it at least in part because a couple of employees at AOL had had difficult pregnancies that cost AOL a lot in healthcare expenses. He called them, quote, distressed babies, which went over about as well as you'd think it went over. So this weekend, Armstrong apologized and changed the 401k changes back again. Marketplace's Mark Garrison picks it up from there.
This isn't the first big apology for Armstrong. Last time, it was after firing an employee during a mass conference call because the worker tried to take a picture of him. Armstrong still has his job because a corporate board decides his fate, not an outraged public. Brian Weiser is senior analyst at Pivotal Research Group.
He'll be cut some slack for these comments, in large part because of the overall business performance.
Not that AOL is doing fantastic. There are still big questions about its future. But the most recent earnings report showed an increase in revenue, and that's ultimately what matters to corporate boards, even when CEOs say offensive things.
As long as they're bringing in the money, this is what I always say, you can be an incredible jerk.
But Stanford management professor Bob Sutton also points out that when unlikable leaders have only numbers to protect them, it's awfully lonely when those numbers change.
The problem you've got is you don't realize that your enemies are lying in wait. And boom, when the performance goes south, you can get pushed out very, very quickly.
CEO gaffes are especially problematic for a company like AOL, which needs to draw an audience. Dartmouth management professor Sidney Finkelstein says bad press from bad behavior can drag the numbers down.
It becomes a pretty powerful force in the Twitter world and on Facebook and the bloggers talking about all the things they don't like about this guy. That starts to add up. In other words, it could have a business effect, a business impact.
And investors may already be walking away. AOL stock dropped more than 3% today. In New York, I'm Mark Garrison for Marketplace.
You know how there are things out there that don't always make sense? Happens a lot in business and the economy, which is why we came up with a new series where you guys ask the questions and we get one of our reporters to answer them. It's called I've Always Wondered.
If you wonder...
By asking 1,000 questions to get one answer, by brain work and labor.
We've got a twofer today. Two questions about rental cars. One from listener Barry Reeves, who wondered why cars are so cheap to rent, considering their value. And this one from Breanne Hallback in Atlanta, Georgia.
I've always wondered why rental car companies give you two keys that you can't separate.
I know, right? Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman picks it up from there.
I started my quest to answer the two identical keys mystery sitting at a cafe, searching for sources on my laptop, and sitting next to me was Patty Parker. She drives a Porsche, rents cars a lot for work, and I asked if she had any ideas about the keys.
I think they like the fact that it's bulky so that you don't lose them.
Decent guess, though it's wrong. And this is personal for me. Here's what happened. A few months back, I rented a car from Hertz in New York City. Long story short, a parking attendant locks both keys in the car. I call Hertz, they send AAA. I'm charged like $130. I tell the AAA guy, if these keys weren't attached, I wouldn't have this problem. He offers to cut them apart.
I'm gonna cut them apart.
And his bolt cutter can't even do it. That wire is like titanium or something. Obviously, I need to go to the source for the answer. I head to Enterprise Rent-A-Car in my neighborhood. Ian McGrath is behind the counter.
So there's multiple locations. We share cars between branches. And since we have more than one key set, each car comes with two sets. You just want to have both sets together when we sell the car.
So this has nothing to do with us as consumers. It's about the value of the car for resale. Replacing a key can cost $400. Paula Rivera at Hertz explains.
We have about 500,000 cars in our fleet. So logistically, it's very difficult for us to store the second set somewhere and then match it up with the original car.
I put it to her that it's a real pain for renters if they lose the keys or lock them inside like I did.
Hertz actually offers a premium roadside service. So for approximately an additional $650 a day, things such as keys locked in cars or lost keys are included in that service.
Oh my God, she just tried to upsell me with the premium roadside service. And that brings us to the other question a listener asked. How do the rental companies make money? Well, first, they buy so many cars, the automakers cut them big discounts. And they've figured out the formula to make sure those cars are on the road 80% of the time. Jack Gillis of the Consumer Federation of America says where they really push for profits is the add-ons.
There's virtually no reason to buy the auto insurance if you own your own car and have your own insurance policy.
10% of revenue comes from car seats, gasoline, insurance, GPS, stuff we opt for at the counter because of convenience or a hard sell.
Many of us fall victim to pay for the full tank up front, and the only way that's ever going to pay off is if you return the car and roll in running on fumes.
And finally, the companies get pretty good resale value when they unload the cars 20 or 25,000 miles later. Patty Parker, the woman I met at the cafe, bought a former rental, a Kia, from a dealer. And she didn't even know it.
I rent cars all the time.
and they discuss me.
Many states don't require dealers to disclose that to used car buyers.
You know, we felt like we'd kind of not been given the whole story.
There's this longstanding perception that renters are worse than Evel Knievel.
Chris Brown is with Auto Rental News, and he says don't shun the lowly rental on the used car lot.
But I don't know people who get into a rental and decide to do donuts in McDonald's parking lot. The majority of rental cars are driven by people between the ages of 25 to 65. They hold credit cards, so they have some financial means.
At the end of the day, the rental car companies aren't going to make the profit they need if they don't resell at top dollar. And a top dollar resale car comes with two keys. So it seems our two I've always wondered answers are cabled together by titanium and can't come apart either. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
My personal favorite question about rentals, what's the only car that goes 50 miles an hour in reverse? Any rental car. Thanks very much. I'll be here all week. Don't forget to tip your waitress, everybody.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note on the way out, another day, another delay for the ACA. Yes, that's a lot of rhymes. The White House announced today it's going to give medium-sized companies, that means places that have between 50 and 99 employees, an extra year before they have to offer health insurance to their full-time workers. Bigger companies, that is, with 100 or more people, also got a break on how quickly they need to start providing coverage for their workers. Basically, just about everybody gets a little bit longer to figure this whole thing out. And with that, that is Marketplace from APM on this Monday. Today, the Dow shaved off 7 points. That's about 0.05%. The NASDAQ up 22 points, 0.5%. The S&P 500 nudging up 2 points. That's a little more than 0.1%. Our daily production team includes Bridget Bodner and Tommy Andres. Millie Jefferson directs the program. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.